The more members of Congress can avoid making difficult decisions, the easier it is for them to achieve perpetual re-election.
Since toppling longtime incumbent Bob Bennett in the 2010 primary, and then riding the Tea Party wave to become the junior senator from Utah, Mike Lee has been one of the most careful and liberty-friendly legal minds in public office. As a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Lee will participate in the upcoming confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. In fact, he was almost in the hot seat himself. The senator was one of seven finalists considered by President Trump to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. I sat down with Mike Lee to discuss that selection process, as well as concerns over Kavanaugh's Fourth Amendment views and the latest on the senator's longstanding goal of getting a sentence reform bill onto Trump's desk.
Senator Lee, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So you got snubbed again. It's like two times you've been snubbed by the president for not coming on the Supreme Court. Are you licking your wounds? How do you feel about that?
Well, look, I'm honored to have even been considered, honored to have been on the list, along with my brother. My brother's on the Utah Supreme Court. He was also on the list.
Who's actually better between you and your brother?
Oh, my brother, hands down.
Okay.
But, you know, if it's going to be anyone other than him, I'd like to be considered.
I know you don't want to talk about specific conversations that you had with the president, or I presume if you want to spill the beans, that's fine. But can you give any kind of sense of his preparation, his interest, his his approach towards the issue? Because his naming of judges has been a pretty interesting part of his presidency.
It's my understanding the president's been very involved in this process from day one. And he was very involved in the process of interviewing candidates. And I commend him for that. I also commend him for having put together a list of people. He put together a list of people while he was still a candidate and said, these are the kinds of people I'll consider for the Supreme Court. I think that's helpful.
So tell us a little bit about Brett Kavanaugh, your initial ideas, what the things that you want to hear from him, what's your assessment of him from what you know so far?
What I want to hear from him is that he's a textualist originalist. He's someone who will defend the Constitution, that he's someone who will start each case with the assumption that there is a right answer under the law, that he's got to find it, even though it's difficult, even though some people might disagree about what the right answer is. A textualist originalist is someone who will interpret the law based on what it says rather than on the basis of what the jurist might wish it said.
Or what the administrative regulatory state interprets it as being out there in the wild.
Precisely. Precisely. Now, this may sound really ordinary, very mundane to say that you want someone who will just read the law based on what it says. It's actually kind of novel. And, I mean, in recent history, just in the last few decades, we've had members of the Supreme Court, including people who have been appointed by both political parties, who take more of an approach that says, I want to find what the right answer is, what answer feels right to me, and then let the law back in to the result. That's kind of a problem.
But you also have, I mean, the Supreme Court is not immune to politics, right? And not immune to not wanting to be too far ahead on certain issues. Or he, as he wrote, I believe, in a dissent on an early Obamacare case, you know, we should have a sense of deference about jumping into a hot-button political fray. So that also comes into it, right? Your sense of both on precedence and how much you want the Supreme Court to butt in on things that the legislature or the politics writ large are wrestling with.
In my view, the courts shouldn't even be focused on that. The courts should be focused on finding what the right answer is, finding what the text says, finding what the statute or the constitutional provision in question have to say, and then applying that to the case at hand.
There are people who I think share a lot of your overall approach to life in Congress. You might dispute that, but you don't get to, who are worried about Kavanaugh and the Fourth Amendment, particularly third-party doctrine on the cases like the Carpenter case that just came up. Is that a worry of yours? Is that something that you're going to be focusing on when you look at him?
The Fourth Amendment is a big deal to me. I believe in the Fourth Amendment. I think we need a strong Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment is one of the reasons why we don't fly the Union Jack in this country, one of the reasons why we don't sing God Save the Queen. It's one of the reasons for the American Revolution. We've got to stand behind it. And that includes staying on top of technology so that the government doesn't find creative ways of circumventing the privacy rights protected by the Fourth Amendment. It's one of the reasons why I was so concerned from almost the moment I got into the Senate 7.5 years ago about the government's practice of acquiring bulk telephone metadata. Bulk telephone metadata collection is kind of a fancy term for gathering all the information on basically every telephone in the United States. Who called you, when you talked, how long you talked. It's a gross invasion of privacy, and this was done without any warrant, without any showing that you or any other owner of any other phone line had done anything wrong or had any connection to a national security investigation. This was wrong. It's one of the reasons I authored the USA Freedom Act, which in 2015 was signed into law and ended bulk metadata collection. Now, the opinion you refer to, the claimant opinion, is one that was authored by Judge Kavanaugh in that case. Interestingly enough, that case had become moot, as I recall, by the time the case came before Judge Kavanaugh. And so it was mooted, in fact, by the USA Freedom Act. Oh. So I'm going to ask some questions of Judge Kavanaugh. I want to find out more about why he wrote separately on that point.
If he answers in the worst possible way from your point of view, could that be a deal breaker for you?
Well, look, I think this is someone who's going to be confirmed. And I think this is someone for whom every Republican in the Senate is going to vote. Barring something unforeseen, barring something that I don't anticipate right now, I do think he'll be confirmed. But I do have questions, and that's why we have a process.
You talked about the president's approach towards the judiciary and nomination. Your colleague and majority leader, Mitch McConnell, oftentimes describes the Senate as a personnel kind of department, and the personnel that they're trying to hire or move through are judges. How would you assess how the Trump administration has done in filling judges, given your very, very keen interest in the judiciary, in the Supreme Court, and other elements of the judiciary? How would you rate how that process has gone?
As a member of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, I've had a front row seat to this. And overall, I'd give the Trump administration very, very high marks on this. For the most part, these judges have been top quality, top notch. I was very impressed, for example, with Judge Gorsuch, now Justice Gorsuch. I hope that Judge Kavanaugh will sort of fit into that same category, along with Justice Alito, for whom I clerked, along with Justice Thomas, along with Justice Scalia. The lower court appointees have also been very, very good. So I'm pleased with this administration, what it's done to repopulate the federal judiciary as vacancies have occurred.
Has that been a positive surprise? I recall us talking at the Republican convention, which we were a little red-faced at times about the proceedings that are going on the floor, and we're not, I don't think, could be accurately described as a big fan of Donald Trump at that moment. Are you surprised by the quality, given what you thought at that time?
I don't know if I would say surprised. I had some uncertainties that I expressed in 2016, as you and a number of other people witnessed. They were uncertainties based on the fact that this was someone who was a newcomer. We didn't know a whole lot about him. He didn't have a political track record. But I would say I've been very pleased. Those uncertainties with regard to what he would do with the federal judiciary, these are things that have made me very happy. I've been very pleased with this administration in that regard.
I'm going to go out on a limb and presume that you're not as happy about his trade policies.
Less so.
And approaches. This week, y'all passed a non-binding Senate resolution criticizing the president's approach on tariffs. I saw a lot of people say, hey, this is a great first step. I also saw a lot of people saying, non-binding, what's wrong with you guys? Can you bind something? First, just generally speaking, can you assess the administration's approach so far on trade and the tariffs and the trade war and your sense of that? And then maybe we'll get into the Senate's role and Congress's role and what you see it as doing or not doing to kind of combat it or oversee it.
I respectfully, but very strongly, disagree with the president's decision to invoke Section 232 to impose massive tariffs on steel and aluminum. First of all, I don't think there is any national security-related predicate need established that would even invoke this. Secondly, I think this puts far more American jobs in jeopardy than it could possibly save. We've got far more American jobs that involve making things with steel and aluminum, which are themselves fungible commodities traded in international markets. Far more people are employed in America making or selling things that involve steel or aluminum as inputs than we do people who are making steel and aluminum. Moreover, with steel, for example, we can satisfy all of our national security needs with just 3% of domestic steel output, just domestic steel output. That makes it almost impossible, in my mind, to establish the predicate need to invoke Section 232 in the first place. Look, I believe that there are no winners in a trade war, only losers. And I say this as the grandson of a Treasury man, a T-man, one of the few law enforcement officers that existed back in the 1930s and 40s, were the T-men. My grandfather helped enforce the Smoot-Hawley Trade Tariff Act, and he bemoaned the fact that that had been his job for years. He, late in life, he used to experience guilt over it. I mean, it was his job. He was just doing his job. But he used to warn me that that's one of the things that you just don't do. It's like never fight a land war in Asia and don't start a trade war because they tend to result in, or at least exacerbate, global depressions. So I want to keep us out of trade wars. I think it's a mistake to start going down this road, and I hope the president will reconsider. These are conversations I've had with the president, both before and since he's made the decision to invoke Section 232.
What is Congress doing about this right now? Is a non-binding resolution, does that amount to a hill of beans?
It's not nothing, but it's not nearly sufficient. As you point out, I mean, it's a little bit like the unarmed English bobby, who, being unarmed upon seeing the commission of a crime, might say, stop, or I'll yell stop again, this time more harshly. What we need is something binding. What we need is to look to the example of 1980. In 1980, President Carter, with a Democratic Congress in place, slapped some 232 tariffs on petroleum imports. Congress, a Democratic Congress, in both the House and the Senate, said no and passed legislation to undo that action. President Carter vetoed that action. Both houses of Congress then overrode that veto. That's the kind of thinking we need to be involved in. That's exactly what we need to do.
Bob Corker gave a speech about a month ago, I believe that was on the question of tariffs, and he put it in the context of, we don't pass anything here. We don't pass amendments. We don't do any, what the hell are we doing? If we actually voted on this, it would pass. If we had an actual sense of the Senate more than a non-binding resolution, it would probably pass, and yet it doesn't get offered. What is going on with that?
It's a problem. This is supposed to be the world's greatest deliberative legislative body. I'm not even sure what that means anymore. But what it's supposed to mean is that it's a place with theoretically unlimited debate. It's a place where anyone can offer up an amendment. Anyone can offer up legislation and have it voted on. And not just gimmicky legislation, not just something that expresses the sense of the Senate in some abstract way, but actual legislation. That's what we need to do. And we especially need to do that here in the area of trade.
It just feels like Congress has been in a long, pretty steady descent in terms of abdicating its responsibility on any number of things. I mean, just pass a budget. Can we pass a normal budget with appropriation bills and things like that? You came into the Senate as a reformer, as a young voice. You were a Tea Party guy back when there was a Tea Party. And, you know, you toppled the establishment, bringing some energy and some kick into the place, partly from a sense of, well, we need to have more rich oversight over the executive branch. What's going on? Why is there, are the incentives so strong to not do anything and just have a single up and down vote on a cromnibus bill at the end of the year? What explains the way it doesn't work?
It's the drive for perpetual reelection. That's at the center of
even
so
every
much
6 years
world,
reelection. Washington.
Yes, exactly. But the more members of Congress can avoid making difficult decisions, the easier it is for members of Congress, whether they're in the House or the Senate, Republican or Democrat, the easier it is for them to achieve perpetual reelection. And so that's why you've seen this odd confluence of events. You've seen the centralization of power being taken from the people, moved to Washington. But then within Washington, there's a second step where the power is transferred from the people's elected lawmakers in the House and Senate over to unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats in the executive branch who are not accountable to anyone. They're not accountable to the voters through election. They're not really even most of the time accountable to anyone who is in turn accountable to the people through election. This is bad for everyone else, but it's good for a small handful of politicians who find that this process makes it easier for them to get reelected. And it's bad for the American people. It is, by the way, very good for a small handful of experts in Washington, D.C., who become wealthy off of the complexity that surrounds Washington, D.C. You raised a related point, by the way, in referring to the way we spend money, by the way we pass appropriations bills, More often than not, we don't have a regular process in which individual members are allowed to craft legislation or change the way that our spending bills are put together. We're instead given a pile of papers, sometimes a couple thousand pages long, a few hours before the expiration of a spending deadline. That's wrong. When there's no opportunity for debate, for discussion, for amendment, for individual members to improve it, you've effectively disenfranchised almost 300 million Americans. Unless you're one of those lucky four members, named perhaps Ryan, Pelosi, McConnell, or Schumer, then you're being shut out of the process. That's not right.
It's malpractice. It's stunning that it happens, even though we can sort of understand the patterns of it. You are trying to do something with criminal justice reform, which is an issue that the administration has expressed, perhaps surprising to some, interest, at least in some of the prison reform aspects to that. You seem to be optimistic about some work that you're doing to match up with a House bill. Can you talk us through what's in front of you?
Sure. In the last Congress, we proposed something called the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, passed through the Judiciary Committee with a bipartisan supermajority vote of 15-5. This year's version of it passed out of this Congress's Senate Judiciary Committee with a vote of 16-5. It contains two basic provisions, two basic titles, one title dealing with sentencing reform, making some necessary adjustments to minimum mandatory sentence laws that sometimes result in excessive prison sentences for low-level, nonviolent drug offenders in particular. The other title deals with prison reform, preparing people to be released into the general population, helping to make sure that they're ready to go back out, that they've got the skills, the coping mechanisms, and some of the basic educational inputs necessary to make sure that they stay away from crime. The House of Representatives has passed the prison reform portion of that. I believe that can pass the Senate, but it can pass the Senate most likely only if we add a few sentencing reform provisions to it. I think if we do that, we can get most or all the Republicans and most of the Democrats to join with us. We could get this passed this year.
And what's your sense of the House accepting some of the sentencing reform guidelines?
I think it's very high because these are common sense revisions that we're making. This is not going to result in opening the floodgates and letting out a whole host of dangerous felons onto the streets. These are relatively modest adjustments so that we can get away from this Byzantine labyrinth of laws that sometimes results in some people going to prison for 55 years for selling 3 dime bags of marijuana over a 72-hour period just because they had a gun on their person at the time.
The president or the administration, people around him, have indicated, at least last when I looked at it, which is longer ago than when you did, obviously, they're interested in the prison reform, the sentence reform, not so much. Jeff Sessions, your former colleague, I don't think is a big fan of that and a lot of other criminal justice reforms that I might like to see. What is your sense of being able to talk the administration into agreeing to take on some of that sentencing reform that you would also like to see?
First of all, I think it would be a mistake to suggest that everyone close to the president is opposed to any idea related to sentencing reform. Okay. Secondly, I think there's an understanding that prison reform is necessary, and if the price of doing that involves some modest sentencing reform, so be it. Let's get it done. That's why I expect victory sometime between now and a few months from now.
That's very positive news indeed. You think the president is enjoying the applause that he receives when he uses his commutation and pardoning power there?
Absolutely. I think he enjoys doing that, and I think he's used that power pretty well from what I can discern. I think he's identified some instances in which people have been mistreated by a large, overpowering federal government, one that has sometimes overextended itself, particularly in the area of criminal law enforcement.
Last subject before we let you go, you're interested in passing a kind of thing having to do with the Antiquities Act, allowing a president to willy-nilly use the Antiquities Act to federalize more or national parkize land instead of me describing it. Why don't you and tell us what you're up with of that?
Sure. The federal government owns close to 30% of all the land mass in the United States. It's not evenly distributed at all. Most of it's in the western United States. In every state east of Colorado, the federal government owns less than 15% of the land. In many, if not most states, it's a percentage that can be reckoned in the single digits. In every state west of Colorado, the federal government owns a lot more than 15% of the land. In the case of my state, Utah, the federal government owns 2/3 of the land. that limits our ability to control our own access to that land, what we can use it for. Federal land itself can be accessed with some local input, as long as it's within some categories. But under the Antiquities Act, passed some 110, 112 years ago, the president has the unilateral power to designate an area as a national monument. Once it's made a monument, that federal land is put into a higher level of restriction. It's much more difficult to access, much more difficult for local populations to determine the rules surrounding access to that land. Utah has fallen victim to this, and in fact, we've been the victim of millions of acres of monument designations by presidents who have done so, have made these designations contrary to the will of local populations. And so it's one of the reasons why I'm proposing that Utah be given a special protection, a protection analogous to what Wyoming already has and Alaska already has. In Utah's case, my bill would say that if a president wants to designate any more of our land as a national monument, it can't take effect until you first have approval from Congress and you also have approval from our state legislature. I don't think that's too much to ask, especially when America's poor and middle class, particularly poor and middle class people in Utah, are most deeply affected by this land. We shouldn't be subjected to any more of this without our consent.
The counterargument to that you'll hear from environmentalists is that you are preventing the president from protecting some of the most beautiful land in the country, which Utah it undoubtedly is, and therefore you're just going to strip mine it for whatever nefarious reasons that you're doing it. What's your response to that?
I could not disagree with that statement more strongly. Look, no one wants to protect that land more than those who live closest to it. Suggesting that we want to do this so that we can drill under Delicate Arch or Double Arch or some other national landmark, some other beautiful place is absurd, and it's contrary to the facts on the ground. The fact is that no one cares more about that land than the people living closest to it. But they understandably, justifiably, want to have some input into how they access that land, rather than having those decisions made thousands of miles away by a government bureaucrat accountable to no one.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Senator Mike Lee, for future Supreme Court Justice Mike Lee, for talking to us. For Reason, I am Matt Welch.